Welcome to another episode of the Designers FM podcast. On the show, we talk a lot about starting your own business, go build stuff, be creative, that sort of stuff. That seems like a good thing in these times, but how do you start freelancing? How do you define your rate? How do you get clients? To answer those questions, I sat down with two amazing freelancers, Frederik Matti and Stephen O'Neill. Frederik is an amazing illustrator, having done work for Intercom, Spotify, and Deliveroo. Stephen is, next to a great creative director working for companies as Uber and WeTransfer, also a founder of a sustainable food company, superfood company, called Yamba Health. I'll put their websites in the show notes so you can check it out for yourself. Let's get started with the episode.
Designers FM.
Designers FM.
Designers
FM.
Designers FM.
Designers FM.
Designers FM.
Welcome to another episode of the Designers FM podcast. Today we have an episode about freelancing because I think in these times a lot of people are trying to find a new job and find a new challenge, and the opportunity is there to start your own business. So I thought it's good to record an episode about freelancing, but what about freelancing? So how do you start? What are the tips and tricks from what I think are really interesting stories from two guests that we have on today? First, we have Stephen O'Neill, but I think everyone calls you Stevie. Is that correct?
That's true.
Yes.
Hi there.
Welcome. Welcome, Stephen. And we have Frederik Matti. Am I pronouncing that correct? Awesome.
Yep.
I think, Stephen, you're from Ireland, and Frederik, you're Dutch, but your last name doesn't sound super Dutch. Is that because of some...
That's true. It's funny, we don't actually particularly know where our last name comes from. We only know that we've been Dutch for many generations, and we think it might probably come from Italy or Switzerland, because there it's quite a common name. But here in the Netherlands, it's a very rare name, and basically everyone with the same last name is family,
awesome,
which are like seven people. So,
cool.
It definitely sounds Italian.
It sounds fancy.
It does.
I think you should play on that.
Exactly. Cool. We'll start with you.
I just don't look the part.
Yes, exactly. We'll start with you, Stephen. Could you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you ended up in the freelancing life?
Sure thing. Hello, everybody. Hope you're having a lovely day today. My name's Stevie. I'm a freelance designer and creative director from Ireland. Basically, my story, of course, first of getting to Amsterdam is that I studied in Limerick School of Art and Design in the southwest of Ireland. Lovely college in a horrible city. You should read about it. It's got a very dark history. And I bailed because the job scene was not so good in Ireland at the time. And also, I think everybody in Ireland has this kind of attitude of getting off the island, or at least in my friend group. I think I have one or two friends left in Ireland who haven't moved, and then the rest are in like Japan, Barcelona, la la la. So anyway, I moved over to work for an ad agency called Indie, and then since then moved away from advertising into freelancing to work on a couple of my own businesses, and also freelancing for WeTransfer and Uber as a permalancer, I think is the way to call it, because I've been in a consistent relationship with those two companies. Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. And Frederik, what's your background history?
So I studied to be a designer originally, and I worked in design for a couple of years after graduating. And then I moved into illustration because I realized that drawing rectangles into rectangles wasn't really my thing. And I had been illustrating when I was working as a designer as well for a long time. So I felt like that would be a good avenue to try and see if that is something that I could pursue. Because the funny thing is, when I was in high school and I was looking at things I wanted to do, I really wanted to go to art school, but I never went to art school because I was convinced that I wasn't talented enough or I couldn't draw, which I think is really funny considering now I'm a full-time illustrator and that's how I make all my money.
Yeah,
I think I started freelancing in 2017, maybe 2016. I'm not entirely sure. The time goes so fast. And the style of freelance that I do is client to client. I have a few clients that I work for every week, and I have been for the past like 2-3 years. And those are like my bread and butter clients. But then next to them, I do a lot of projects, basically. So very project-based. I didn't even say where I'm from, I guess. I live in Amsterdam, and which is really lovely. The community here is really good, I think, for illustration and design compared to the rest of the Netherlands. But I think most of that also like changed to online, which is also, for me, the main source of where I get my clients, which is really fun. Yeah, that's about it, I think.
Cool. And the question for both of you, what are the things that you wish you knew before you started freelancing to get you kickstarted? Maybe start with you, Stephen.
I've got to say that I wish I knew it was a real job. I feel like when I was in college, people always treated freelancing as this in-between that you did while you weren't working, or if you were a freelancer, you were unemployed. But the flexibility that you're offered and also the opportunities that can come out of it are obviously, we're sitting with two freelancers, incredible. And I love this line of work. I love this freedom. So yeah, I just wish somebody had let me know that was an option, which I guess is a commentary on like the design schooling system, or at least the curriculum in my college, because we weren't really taught the practicalities of earning money. Just like, here's these skills, and that was great. Here's these skills, use them to make money, but figure that bit out on your own.
Yeah, I think that's pretty common, like for design in general, that it's the what you mentioned. For me, the reason not to go to art school, because it felt a little bit like artsy and not so much like you can make money out of this, which is on the end of the, which is strange, because that's like just something that they really don't teach you when you go to any design education.
Which is really funny, because I am actually glad I didn't go to art school. I think the story is funny, and I think it's funny that I thought I couldn't draw and now I'm drawing, but I'm really glad I didn't, because I ended up going to a design school, and which was way more commercial and practical. And if I didn't have those commercial skills, I think I wouldn't be a good freelancer right now. Because I see the curse of art school all around me from people that are like, they are told that you're never going to make any money. And if you're offered any money, then you should be happy. But we are a business in the end. We're not some sort of...
Yeah. What would you say is your greatest skill outside of your craft? Because like Frederik, you're like amazing illustrator, but what's your greatest skill outside of your craft that really helps like kickstart or grow your freelance career that you need to have?
I think I'm just pretty good at commercially selling myself, which has proven to be a very good thing when it comes to freelancing. I'm not afraid to ask for the money that I'm worth. And if someone's not offering it, then I'm not doing it. And those boundaries are super important. And I don't think I would be a successful freelancer without them. No, so I guess business is my skill.
Yeah. It's a good skill.
Cool. Definitely. Yeah.
Stephen, how about you?
Yeah, I guess it would be something the same when I say I'm good at business, good at selling myself. That's true. Maybe the paperwork I'm a little soft on. And then I think otherwise, just to keep it interesting, my other kind of soft skill would be building communities or being like a community person. So I feel like when I go and work for someone, because I often work in the office, that I tend to bring teams together a little bit. And I see that from my previous clients, that's something they really appreciate about me.
Yeah, bring people together.
Like I grease the team a little bit.
Yeah. So going into the business part a little bit. So I've had conversations with some of my friends also when they started freelancing, really cracking their heads, like, how should I price myself? What's a good rate for myself? This client is like the problem of saying no. Do you have any advice, or can you tell a little bit about like how you manage to be convincible about what your rate is, and if you should charge hourly or daily or weekly or monthly or on a project basis, and where that comes in handy?
Yeah, so I don't really like to work on a project or fixed price basis, because I've had so many times in the past where that's upended for me, and I've ended up doing like staying up late for like weeks on end and like doing way too much work because I'm trying to manage a bunch of different stuff because one brief has run on too long and I need to take new briefs or I'm gonna... So I tend to not do that, and I've settled into this permalancing culture, which I think is strong in Amsterdam. And I guess whenever I've had to argue my rate, what I've always said is, as a freelancer, you generally, whatever you charge, you get a quarter of it. So your first 50% goes on tax and materials, essentially. And then you've got to consider that you're probably going to get about half as many days as you would as a full-time employee.
Yeah,
that's hopping job to job. If you take that other half away, you get a quarter of what you have. So you have to make sure that if you multiply that out, that you're going to be happy with that. And generally in like negotiations, that's calmed the ocean when they're like, whoa, you're charging this? So there's a lot of costs.
So you're being like really open about this story. Hey, this is what I'm charging because I'm ending up with a quarter and I need to pay bills and live a life and also make a profit out of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then when you like take that day rate and multiply the quarter out by 20, which is like the average amount of work days, then it becomes a very normal, like a little bit more than a normal salary, because you're very lucky that if you get those extra days. And of course, like you deserve something for the risk because people are paying you to also be available when they need you. But yeah, like it doesn't end up being crazy after that.
Yeah, it's funny because there's such a myth around people thinking, wow, you're asking so, the prices that you ask are so high. You must be like very rich. You must be doing this and this. I've even had an email from a client or a potential client, we never worked together, obviously, that, and they did like the math, how much I would be making per month. And I'm like, I'm not billing 40 hours a week. I don't think you understand how that works. And then on top of that, I'm paying 50% tax indeed. And then I still have materials and things and time and investments and learning. And if I'm sick, no one's going to pay me. Like, it's not some sort of la la land where we're just like showering in money. I think a lot of people think that way. You could make a lot of money when you're freelancing, but it's not a given.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. If you take the risk and it pays off, I think that's, then you deserve that in some way.
Yeah, like high risk, high reward.
More than half those days. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that even for people in like in Amsterdam now, but especially in the US, people in day-to-day normal jobs, like they earn a lot of money. So it's fair to say that if you're a really good freelancer, both of you are, it's fair that you also earn a lot of, at least like a normal amount of money. Because if you do the calculations that you did, Stephen, and you convert a, I don't know, like a Silicon Valley salary to like an Amsterdam freelance hourly wage, then you'll end up with an absurd hourly rate. But it's just what you end up having. Is this the fact that you're basically bound by the hours you put in it? Is this also for you to consideration to start thinking about like alternative ways to make money? Because I know you sell your prints, for instance, Frederik. Is that like a conscience thing that you did to have a side income?
I actually do not sell any prints right now.
Okay.
I want to, but I am very aware of if I were to sell prints or paintings, because I've started painting as well. That is an extra business. It's not just, oh, that should be fun or whatever. That is an extra business. That means I have to go to the post office. It means that I am having extra tasks next to what I'm doing as a freelancer. And next to the producing the art, there's also like the packaging, the marketing, everything. I have considered doing stuff like that. And I think I will in the future, but I can't just put it on top of my normal freelance work and expect it to just not take any time. So I essentially have to do a step back in what I do freelance and then set up this company. And then at some point, get it hopefully at a point where it won't take much of my energy, because I think that's possible. But in the beginning, it definitely will take a lot of energy. It is definitely something that I strive to have at some point, because wouldn't it be great to have some passive income? But what I'm saying is that sometimes the passive income isn't so passive as it seems.
I have to agree with you on that. An end goal for me, to your point as well, has always been to like have that sustainable recurring income. And I think another way to say it is to also make good money from doing cool things I believe in. I think that's been my mantra since I entered the professional world, because I came across my first frustration in design, which was, oh, I'm actually a salesman for other people's things. And so at a certain point, I was like, wow, I can make all these cool designs for these like uncool companies. And then I say, let's say I like branded a toothpaste.
Yeah.
And then I bring it to my friends and I'm like, hey, design friends, look, I branded this toothpaste. And they have to see around the fact that it's this weird chemical toothpaste made in like wherever that's harming all sorts of things, and be like, wow, you did a really cool job where you like did that letter setting for that. So from that, like wanting to make cool things that I believe in, and from wanting to make that sustainable income, I decided that the only way to survive was to start working for clients where I could make some money and fulfill the dream of creating products that I make and design on my own.
Yeah.
And from there, I actually already started a few kind of side venture gig things. Now they're bigger than that. There's like side companies.
Yeah.
But I very quickly learned that's a lot of work also.
Exactly. Those are almost full-time jobs sometimes, some weeks at least. And even something small as like making art and selling it sounds pretty easy because I'm drawing all day anyway, but it's actually another job.
Yeah, and you're like the art you're making, quote-unquote art you're making, or the illustrations you're making for on your day-to-day job, they are for a client, right?
Exactly.
You can resell those to basically make more income. That's so on the topic of acquiring, I remember in the beginning, I ran my own company with a business partner. And in the beginning, it was really scary. Oh, now we need to get clients. There was no like network there that I could piggyback off. How was that for you? Where do you start your journey of acquiring customers?
It's interesting because I think I build my network mostly on Twitter, which is very interesting because Twitter isn't that much of a visual medium.
Yeah.
But it could be actually. But yeah, I think I've been like very active on Twitter for many years, and I've worked as a designer for a while, and people started noticing my work. And also, I think a lot of people around me helped me build my network and were like, hey, I can't do this job right now, but this person can. So it's like kind of word of mouth has always been for me.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever done acquisition in the most, I don't think I've ever done acquisition actually.
Like cold calling.
I don't think I've ever. Yeah, I don't think I've ever emailed someone saying, oh, I actually did it recently for the first time. But it was also, again, from a tweet. I think I'm just really lucky that I've had consistent enough people ask me to work for them where I haven't really have to reach out to anyone else. This changed recently because this year I started doing paintings and cutouts, which are made from paper. And I was like, I would love to do this for a specific type of client. So then I started looking for that specific type of client by asking it on Twitter, which is something that usually doesn't work, but this time it worked out perfectly fine. And I started working with this Dutch winemaker, which was like my dream and goal for this year. But yeah, in the classical sense, I don't find myself emailing or sending postcards, which is a very old school way of promoting yourself
postcards.
As an illustrator. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
That's what they tell you in art school, apparently, that you have to do.
Really?
You have to send postcards to art directors so they can have a sample of your work and hopefully hire you to do some editorial work.
Yeah. Awesome.
Crazy that you've done so well on Twitter, though.
Yeah, it's been quite a blessing and a privilege to have that there, because I think Twitter has built my career almost completely.
Wow.
Is there...
Thank you, Twitter.
Yeah. Is there anything particular you do on Twitter? Because I can imagine a lot of people now listening, yeah, I'm also on Twitter. I don't have a success.
Yeah, exactly. I don't exactly... I think I just started posting my work. The thing that is very helpful when you're an illustrator is there's a lot of visual stuff that you can promote yourself with. Yeah, I can't resell my work that I did for clients, but I can show the work that I did for clients. So other people are like, I want that. And I think I just started to be active on Twitter with my illustration work when the particular style of work I was doing was very popular. So people just start following you and start recommending you. And it's basically a word of mouth kind of thing as well, but then international, because I immediately started mainly working for American clients, and I actually barely ever work with Dutch clients at all.
Interesting.
So my network is strangely enough very online and very based in America. I think it's just based on strange luck. I think I can't really say, oh, you do these steps and then you'll be successful. The only thing that I really believe in is if there's something you really believe in, you just have to repeat it, because not everyone's gonna see it, read it. If you tweet something once, maybe not everyone's gonna see it. If you're available for work, just say it.
Yeah.
And just make it clear.
I feel a lot of people have this, I think this notion of I don't want to be this annoying person that like retweets themselves or, you know, puts on the same content like 3 or 4 times a week. But I think also, and you'll also have this, like, we're promoting the podcast, you have to be a little bit right? It's sales, right? You have to be a little bit in your face.
You have to be salesy. Like,
you have to be salesy. You exactly. have to go on different networks. You have to be ballsy to drop the link into comments where people talking about a topic that you've covered on the podcast. And okay. And that's just part of the job. And I think both of you, what you said, you're commercially also, like, you have a commercial skill. And Stephen, you also have this like community skill, bring people together. And I think it's hard for maybe those super archetypical, typical designers that just want to work in a silo and do their creative work and are really not outgoing. I think for them, it's mm-hmm. hard to do it. But then again, what you're saying is like Twitter is a great medium to start off showing your work.
So the reason I also didn't jump on that question initially was I've been very networky. So I came over from Ireland to work for an ad agency, which I found literally just searching because I was like, I need to get a job, want to move to Amsterdam, found the ad agency. And then from there, I just met a person who introduced me to a person who introduced me to a person. I'm going to plug Jeanette Snape, who was the person who helped me get into WeTransfer. I met her because she was renting a desk at Indie, which was the ad agency I was at. And she's just been the queen of my career and life. She also helped me get a house at a certain point. So shout out to Jeanette Snape for her great work.
Awesome.
But yeah, I've really just moved from person to person, made friends. They've introduced me to this person and it's really grown in that respect.
It's funny. Sometimes it also just works like that. So for instance, very early in my career, I started working with Intercom and then the person that I worked with, they moved to a different company. So then you work for that company. It's yeah. Sometimes it just... You're being passed around a little bit between these companies where these people are also being passed around a little bit. So yeah.
That's why it's also important to be nice to everyone that you work with and don't burn bridges because yeah. they'll come back.
Yeah. And this industry is so small. You don't want to.
Yeah. Everything you do matters.
So on that of being nice to everyone, you'll both probably have heard of like the expression of clients from hell. And by the way, I totally agree with you. Like never burn the bridges and especially don't like publicly denounce your clients, because I've seen this unfortunately a lot on Twitter where like I worked for this company and they didn't pay the bill and screw this company. And although that might be true, like you don't want to come over as such a person, I think, and you also don't want to burn that
if they didn't pay your bill.
Yeah. So how do you
if they didn't pay your bill, you can denounce them on Twitter or on Instagram or something. That's really not cool.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
but in general, yeah, you generally don't tell your clients from hell that they're clients from hell.
Yeah.
That's a rule of thumb. It's like, work with them. You can end the job. You can make an excuse or otherwise just finish it out and smile and take the money and bill them well. And hopefully they pay. If they don't pay, then you can get angry. But then just walk away and move on because it doesn't generally pay, as you said, to denounce them directly.
Stevie, do you have this thing where if you get a new request from a client to do work for them, that you already like in the beginning have this like gut feeling they are going to be a client from hell? Do you have that?
Yeah, definitely. Straight away. It's like they get pernickety about one little thing on a quotation and you're just like, oh, there it is. That's them.
Yep.
That's your practice though.
Have you ever taken a job from a client from hell, even though you knew they were going to go that way?
I've done worse. I think I've taken like free jobs from clients from hell.
Wow.
Years ago. I definitely don't do it anymore. But like I've had times where I've like taken on jobs where I didn't get paid at all. And I was like, oh, I'll just do it because it seems cool. And like it'll lead to something. But this person sucks. And then it's ended up being like months and months long process where
We
ended up creating something awful because we like worked with the rest of the team obviously wasn't good because they weren't able to attract good talent who could develop it well or whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah, man, I've had this happen this is a couple of years ago. I think it was pretty fresh still and I didn't have any clients for a while and I was like very nervous about it. And then this client came up to me for work and I was like, it sounds fine, but I have a bad feeling about this. But then I had that dilemma when you're like, but you're not making any money and you should pay the rent. So maybe you should not be so stuck up and just take the client because you should be grateful that someone is actually wanting to work with you, which is completely the wrong way to think, I think now. But then I was just like, this is just what you have to do now. Go ahead, do the job, stop complaining. It can be that bad. No, it was the worst thing I've ever done. They demanded, first of all, the pay was too low for what I was doing. Second of all, they demanded weekly calls and they were awful. They were just weird on details as well. They kept saying my name wrong. They kept spelling it wrong. their feedback was just horrible. There was the kind of client where they went, oh, our CEO doesn't really like red because his wife, la la la, like that kind of feedback that no one wants to hear ever. And then they spread the project out for weeks on end, and it was supposed to take only 2 or 3 weeks, and I think I ended up working 6 weeks on it. So the pay that I was getting from them was already low, but then it was nothing. And then on top of that, they didn't pay me for 3 months.
No.
Yeah. These are just like...
So.
Yeah. And you probably then at that point thought to yourself, if ever I could turn back time and don't make these decisions, then this would be the time. So is this something...
That was a hard learning.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're actually bringing up memories for me. I actually got invited a few years ago to become... Well, first I got invited to pitch to do the branding for a very big museum in Amsterdam that's also like a global network of museums. So I really can't name them. I would love to.
We'll guess, but you don't.
No, don't guess. Don't do it to me. You'll get me in a lot of trouble. But anyways, they invited me to pitch alongside 11 other designers, so 12 total. And they invited me on LinkedIn. And I was like, fuck, I don't pitch. No way. Because I had gotten over pitching at that point. And I was like, oh, maybe one more pitch because I really like this. It's been like... This type of museum has been like a character through my childhood. I've gotten like the books from my grandparents all my childhood. It was like a big thing for me to work for these guys. So I pitched and they really liked the idea I came forward with. I did a pretty extensive pitch as well. They were like, okay, cool. We want to work for you. I became their creative director and I even had business cards, like the business cards printed with it. And I like did this whole branding for this museum. And then I think 3 months into the project, I hadn't billed yet and they came to me. I should have phased out the project better. I'm better at that now. But they came to me and they're like, yeah, so we submitted your design proposal to the global headquarters, or even maybe the global headquarters like found out about your design proposal and they've actually been doing their own global rebrand there. So they told us like, we won't get any financial assistance if we use your design. So unfortunately we can't work with you anymore. And we also can't pay you. So I went into this. So then I was like, okay, look, I'm going to come and meet you face to face. And I went and I met the CEO of this museum face to face. And we just sat and we had this like spat for 3 hours about it. And I was like, man, you have to pay me. I've worked hours and hours. And he was like, okay, what I'll do is I'll pay half your invoice. And I was like, and I was really not going to get any further with him. Like I knew we had been for 3 hours in this office. And I was like, I can't do this anymore. Okay, if you'll pay half the invoice, that's fine. And then I like broke ties with them and now they have awful design. There's a horror story. That was a horror story for me because I really liked it. And I like worked my ass off to get into this, to doing this job. And no naming and shaming, but
this is so unfortunate.
I heard a lot of friends of mine like talking about like a union for freelancers where these things could be handled a little bit. Because you're on your own, right? No way you're going to take this big museum, which name was name we never will guess. You're not going to sue them and get them in front of court because that's just, but it's.
Well, I think now I could. Like if something like this would happen to me again and I felt really wronged and la la la, but like I would have contracts lined up in the beginning, quotation, phased out the job, been paid in stages, wouldn't have done so much work ahead of time. Like I would have handled it. Yeah. Because I'm just more mature in my craft now.
This really ties back into what I knew before I started freelancing. Contracts are really important. I think I'm working on this right now myself because usually my clients send me their contracts. And actually, it happens more often than not that the contract doesn't reflect the thing that we negotiated over email.
Yeah.
And what happens a lot in the illustration business is they will make you do work for hire, which means they pay you and then they own your work, which is something that I don't agree with. We can do work for hire, but that's just way more expensive. Yeah. I will give you the rights, but then you have to pay for those because basically my name's not going to be involved anymore with the work. Anyway, they always say, oh yeah, great. We'll do it the way you say it. And then the contract still is a work for hire contract. So what I'm working on right now is I'm looking for, and actually if someone who's listening knows anyone that I should reach out to, I'm looking for someone that can help me set up a contract with me that I can use to send to my clients instead of doing the opposite. So I am like more and better protected. And also, so I don't have to read the stupid contracts all the time, because I don't know about you guys, but I don't do lawyer speak. I don't understand it usually. English is also not my first language, as you might know. It's really hard for me sometimes to see what's happening. And I have definitely in the past blindly signed contracts because I was just, I couldn't be fucked to read the contract, which is super dumb.
Yeah. You gotta at least read them, I think.
Yeah. I've been lucky enough, like when I had my own agency, my business partner was really keen on the small letters. So every time we would get a job offer, like the contract or the offer actually would be one that I would hate to read, because it was like 12 pages. And I think like our terms and agreements were like 9 pages, but those are actually just there to protect you. And I think that's exactly what companies mm-hmm. do when they sign over your contract. It's to protect them. And then like us blatantly just signing them, like, oh, this will be fine. Because after yeah. your horror story, Stevie, I remembered, I wasn't there because I already left the company. But just before I left the company, I got into a disagreement with a client, was actually like a lawyer firm. And they said, yeah, we don't want to pay you because this is not what we sign up for. And actually, I don't remember the outcome of the case, but they actually put it into court. And I remember I had to file all my notes and all the notes from all the meetings that we had together, because they were basically saying, yeah, you didn't, like, there was no feedback involved. You just did something and we didn't agree with it. And after 3 times, we basically just pulled the plug because you weren't doing the work that we were expected to. And I had to deliver like all my notes, like 26th of October, we discussed this and this and this and this. I'm not sure what the outcome of it was going to be, but it's also that, like, the cost of a lawyer and then the cost of going to court. Yeah. You basically, as a freelancer, have to upfront all those costs, hoping that the judge will say you're mm-hmm. right and will give you back all the money. But if you're going to file a lawsuit against a big company, like, they'll just upfront give you all the, oh yeah, if you're going to lose, by the way, you're going to pay all our lawyers, you're going to pay all our time that we spend on this case, so better be ready for mm-hmm. paying it up. And I think that scares a lot of individuals not going to court to challenge those
of
cases.
Of course.
Definitely. Which that's, I think, like,
that's bankruptcy. Like, for a company, for just a one-person company, like, yeah. having to pay some big company's lawyers, that's bankruptcy.
And even the time you spend, you cannot work. The time you spend on, on the case, you cannot work.
But yeah, I've never been here myself, and I hope to never go there as well.
No. I think it really helps to pick out your clients well and to always be friendly, because I think there's going to be issues with clients anyway, and there's going to be disagreements. But if you're going to be friendly, you can be adults and you talk about it and you resolve it. And if you...
Most of the time.
Yeah, exactly.
But also if you work for a law firm and it goes wrong with a law firm, like, you're in hot water there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
Which I think I should shout out to the listeners as well and say that if anyone who's listening is a freelancer in Holland and they do have legal problems, there is a free service called the Juridisch Loket that you can go to.
Yeah.
If you do need legal advice, if anything ever happens. Have you guys ever used that service?
I haven't, actually. The thing where my client didn't pay, I resolved it by calling their office every day.
Yeah.
Cool.
And the funny thing is that they actually returned to me and asked me if I wanted to do more work. And I was like, thanks, but no.
Yeah. I unfortunately had to call for legal advice a few times. But yeah, the Juridisch Loket is good. I think they do. I'm not sure, but I remember that they gave you advice if you were like for consumers, not for businesses. But I'm not sure if that's the case. I think I called them up once and saying like, hey, I need legal advice. And they said, is this for yourself or for your business? And I said, for my business. And then they said, then we cannot help you or something. But it's good to look into it.
I think as an Eenmanszaak, you can go to them. I think it's if you have a BV or something and you're looking for that sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the thing is, if you are a one-person business in the Netherlands, then your business entity and yourself are the same thing.
Yeah.
So I think as a ZZP'er, you can actually get help there. But if you have a BV or a company with multiple people, then you can't.
Cool. Let's switch to some happy stuff, because we've been talking about like legal stuff and horror problems.
Yeah. Let's not talk about law anymore. Yeah.
And people are listening. Should I freelance?
Free designer sitting around talking about the law.
Exactly. So what's the thing you enjoy the most about like being a freelancer?
I love the fact that I can just make my own schedule. And mainly, it makes it possible for me to not work 40 hours a week. I can, and sometimes I do, but I try not to because that's just the lifestyle that fits me the best. And I talked about picking up painting and stuff, and that's just stuff sometimes I feel like I need to do. It's not like I wanted to do that or something, but it's almost like a need. So it feels really good for me to have the space and time to do those things and not just think about them and do them after work, which is very heavy. And I also like that I have a lot of power over what kind of projects I take on. So if you work at an agency, then you have to do what the agency gets. Yeah. And sometimes you find yourself working for clients that you may possibly not agree with. And here I can navigate those myself for the most part. What I mean by that is that sometimes when you need the money, you need the money. But fortunately, I haven't been in that situation. But yeah, I like that I, you know, can make sure that I mostly draw for good. And yeah, and my own free time. And also, I know that you, Stevie, work mainly from client side, but I never work from client side. And I just love having the control over my own surroundings and if I'm going to work from home or from my office or stuff like that. Yeah. Makes it really good for me as well.
Yeah, for me, I totally get that. But one thing I really like is like helping people on their mission to do something great. And of course, I have my own missions. And as I said, I'm like a projects guy turned entrepreneur, and I'm doing a bunch of other stuff. So personally, I really like the freedom of freelancing because it allows me to set my schedule, take time off when I need it, block time so I can go and work on my other projects. Also travel, because I love to travel. But in terms of working with clients, I'm currently working with WeTransfer a couple of days a week, and I've been working with them since 2015. That's where I went after the ad agency Indie, and I joined them as like their second wallpaper developer, and they took me on as a freelancer there, and then I turned into a full-time employee. And then since last September, I'm back working with them. And like a couple of things that I really like about freelancing in terms of working client side, especially with them, because I really agree with their mission. I love the company because I was like the 29th employee when I joined back then. So I really know the company from when it was something much smaller and much different. And now it's like this huge, amazing thing. Is I really like working with them on their mission. And I also like, in terms of a freelance negotiation or relationship, that it establishes you as two value-adding parties to each other. So you know that you're working with them because like they pay you and the work is good and you like doing what they do, but they're also very much like, we're paying this guy, he's here on a freelance basis, we better use him, we better work with him directly, we better focus on what we're spending that time on. And that makes the relationship much more interesting for me. And it also means that everything you're doing for them, as opposed to when maybe I've been an employee and there's a week where there's not much going on or you're focusing on other stuff. It's like when you're there, you're always really focused on something meaningful. And that's one thing that I really like about the kind of freelance or like permanence relationship.
Yeah. It's such a different way of working than what I do, because I'm if people ask, the thing is, Dutch clients for some reason always ask me to sit on client side, which is something I don't really like, because especially when it's a short project, which is usually what I do, most of my projects are like a week, 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, but usually not much longer than that. It just takes me so much energy to get used to the environment, to get used to all these new people that I don't know. People are also like curious because they don't often see an illustrator in the wild. So they're like, wow, what are you doing? Or drawing, or, oh, so cool. You're like drawing all day, that would be a cool job. Like all those things make it super hard for me to do my best work for them and to make sure I can do my best work. I rather sit in my own space and communicate via phone or Slack, or I can go over for meetings or something like that. But like when it comes to doing the actual heavy lifting for the project, I rather sit in my own space.
Yeah,
and that's worked really well for me.
Do you feel like it's misspent time?
Going to the office, yeah.
Like it's just a waste?
Yeah, I think it's a waste for both of us, because I'm going to be more tired and less happy, and that will make me do less better of a job. And then, like, it sometimes feel like clients want this because then I have feeling of control. But if they really understand the way I work, then they know that they'll end up with a worse thing than I could have done when I just have my time at my office, because I'm faster, I'm more relaxed, and that just contributes to me doing way better work. And as an illustrator, this is also different, I think, from being a designer. As an illustrator, you're usually working solo. Like, you're working with a marketing team, or you're working with a designer or an art director sometimes, which is my favorite. You are producing something for them that is going to be fit into a design. So that's, there's communication happening there, but it's not, we're doing different tasks. It's different from as a designer working with a designer in that sense.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine. How do you make sure, I read about this on Twitter, I think last week, how do you make sure that when you present your work to the company you're working for, that you get the right feedback? Because one of you already said, yeah, they want me to use the color red because the boss's wife likes red. And I think everyone who's been in design has had this conversations or meetings where they had to listen to people argue about these things where you don't want to argue about as a designer. How to make sure that you present your designs in a way that the feedback you get is valuable, because as a freelancer, your time is even more precious and valuable.
I'm personally very clear on what I need for feedback. So if I'm I've fine-tuned this over the years, but I have different stages of work that I do. So sketches, then roughs, and then final, for instance. And then sometimes I even send what rough means, what final means, what the detail level is. And then when I send over sketches, I particularly say, hey, the hands will look like shit. We don't have to talk about that, because that's something we'll do in the rough stage, for instance. And then I'll be like, right now it's time to give your feedback about composition, because that's the thing that I can change really easy now. But further in the project, that means a redraw. So I'm very focused on telling them what I want to hear.
Yeah.
And when I want to hear it, because otherwise you will get into that conversation where it's, I really love this, but the hand is a little bit weird, and can we fix that? And then they want you to do very detailed sketches of things. And that's just, you're just losing time, because you will make those nice later. And that also, there's a little bit of trust involved there as well, I think. And it also really depends on what the team is that you're working with. Because if someone's really used to working with illustrators, you don't have to be this overly clear. But if someone's super new to it, you have to guide them and teach them how to work with you. I think that is the biggest thing. I try to teach my client how they should work with me. And that's something I invest a lot of time and energy into, write out what they can expect.
Client education.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think
that's great. If I'm working at WeTransfer, it tends to be very clear how people need to give feedback on the wallpapers I've created. So there's no real need for any education there, because everybody knows what they're doing. But like I said before, at the moment, I'm mostly working on my own side projects. And so I tend to not, I work a lot on my own as the designer and kind of creative director in those projects. And then it works on a presentation and sign-off base, as opposed to a presentation and feedback base. But one thing I will say that I do actually quite often is I build in false choices in presentations. So I take details that are really insignificant, and this is a horrible thing to say, but it is really something you need to learn to do when you work in situations where there are sometimes there's a couple of voices in the room, is you build in things and discussion points, and you're how should we approach this shade of green or whatever, or how should we approach how thick this line is, and it just means that a discussion erupts, and then for the next few slides you can get through without a discussion, and then you're I need to pitch them something else that they might not agree with, I'll put in a choice just before it, they'll feedback on that, and then I'll be able to just get sign off on all the stuff I want to get sign off on.
Yeah, that's a really good trick.
That's great.
Yeah, it's very much about the art of the presentation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Having a defined process, upfront, where you can set expectations for your clients. This is the work that I'm going to do. And I think I've worked with, you also know Jort probably, Larka, more known as an illustrator. I've worked with him. And also his process was super clear, right? It's really clear upfront. I'm going to go through these phases. In these phases, we'll probably have time for one or two revisions. If you want more revisions, fine, it costs you more. And I think the scary thing is that a lot of freelancers are scared upfront to be super clear about the expectations because they don't want to scare off their clients before they actually start. And that's where the trouble ends, because they're going to be fuzzy about it. And then halfway, it's like, oh, this is like the third revision already. I'm actually over time and it's not going to work. And then you have to try to control it back. And I think that's always where you're like a step late. And I think that goes in the same thing with contracts.
But it's funny what you said about manipulating the presentation like that, because I think it's not really a thing that's spoken a lot about. I think most people know about this. I guess it's also a thing when you're working for a company in a way. But yeah, sometimes there's people in the room that just don't know what's going to be best for them. And you as a professional do know that. And sometimes you just need something to say about something for them to feel right about the work that you're doing, which is, it's a really good thing to think about this as well, because what I've particularly learned is that some people just do not understand what a sketch is, for instance, which is something that is really hard for me to imagine. But if I don't explain what a sketch is and what they can expect from the sketch, they will freak out and they'll be afraid that they will fuck up the project, which is something that you never want to give your client that feeling. Yeah.
I also don't work in three options anymore. That's usually the like classic, is to work to give three options for a logo or three options for colorways or whatever. I just give one and I'm like, check this out. What do you think? This is my idea. You might have a second direction in the back pocket, just so if things go horribly wrong, you can pull it out depending on who you're working for.
Yeah. But
I find it much more successful, much calmer process. That stupid third option that you don't want anybody to choose doesn't always get chosen, which is also the classic. Yeah. And you generally know with your Sagmeister, Stefan Sagmeister from Sagmeister and Walsh, and now he's back on his own. He always said with your gut instinct, what's good for the project. And so he's outlined in his answers to people his way of working. It's, if they don't like it, just tell them you're going to go back to the drawing board and do it all over again.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think there's this false assumption I hear a lot of the times where people say, yeah, you need to present at least 3 or 4 or 5 different iterations of a thing to like your client or your manager if you work at a company. And I think it's fine to do all these iterations like on your own, in your own exploratory phase, because I can imagine like Frederik, where you're starting, you maybe sketch 3 or 4 or 5 different directions, but at some point you know, and that's also where they pay you for, like your skill. Okay, this is direction that I should be going for. Because otherwise, the problem is you present these three options where one you like and the two you obviously hate, but you just present them to give them options and then you'll see they'll pick that third option. And then you have to fight this entire battle. Exactly.
We're experts, man.
Yeah.
That's one thing like we should all remember, is we own our craft and we've been doing it for a long time. And people are hiring people with a real skill who work in that industry. You don't go to a doctor and you're like, give me the three options for dealing with my headache. Or you're like, I'm going to choose though.
Yeah.
But just give me which three medicines do you think would maybe...
And especially if there's a bad medicine in there, right? Like you can pick these two. They don't really work, but I'm going to present them to you anyway. Like that never happens.
You can have the paracetamol, the aspirin, or the sugar pill. Sugar pill sounds real good. Yeah.
Awesome. So I think we're almost done, but I always want to end these kind of episodes with a take for like a call to action for the people that are listening and that are maybe looking into starting freelancing. So what if you're completely new, so you don't have any clients, you have never worked at a company, like what would be the first advice you give to someone who's going to start freelancing, given that you have all the knowledge and experience you have now?
Get an accountant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good one.
Definitely.
Before you do anything else.
Get Case the bookkeeper. He's great.
Yeah. I think there's like numbers on it that like 1 in 5 startups fail because they don't have their financial shit together.
Yep. Get an accountant. And also think about your rate first. The thing that Stevie pointed out in the beginning of this episode is very valuable. Don't count yourself rich, because there's a lot of people that fail because they think, wow, usually I get 2,000 euros per month, and now I'm getting it for one job. And especially if you're very new and you're just out of school, those numbers can seem like very big, but they end up not being so big. And then there is a real opportunity there for you to get in great debt. That's also why I'm saying get an accountant, but also think about what you need to make per year to keep your life going, and not just to keep it going, but to have it comfortable.
Yeah.
And make sure you think about those taxes and the investments that you need to do, because if your laptop falls from your lap tomorrow, you need to be able to buy one immediately. You need to be able to go to the Apple store, yeah, or to wherever the hell, and just get a new computer immediately. You need to have savings for stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I think one of the other things that's also very helpful, and I've done this as well, is if you can, if you are in a different job, make sure you have some savings. Make sure you have a couple of months rent in your pocket. So that made me feel, so when I first started, that was something that really liberated me, because I felt like I don't have to take every job on that is presented to me. I can be picky.
Yeah.
Because you will get hired for the work you will be doing. So for instance, if you start doing the work that you don't like, you're going to be hired to do more of the work that you don't like.
Yeah.
Especially in the beginning, I feel like it's very important to be super picky about what you do and why. Because you're trying to establish yourself, and having the financial support that you've made yourself to make sure you can actually make those decisions is very important and is very liberating.
Yeah, it's also about trying not to get into a situation where you also feel desperate to take on something that might not be a good choice for you.
Yeah.
To speak to your point from earlier, when you said like you took on a client and you knew it was going to be a nightmare client, and you're like, oh, but I have to pay the rent. And if you can avoid getting into that situation,
yes,
that's great. So do whatever you can to not end up in that situation. And yeah.
Right. Because I actually ended up not being able to do a different client that was way better and better suited for me, because I was doing the shit job. So I missed out in the end. I missed out on more money.
Yeah. And don't overwork and burn out. That's also important. Like, I sometimes work so freaking hard, and
yeah,
it really takes a toll on you. Maintaining your weekends and your evenings if you can, or if you're an evening worker, like spending, like having your mornings, it's like taking time for yourself is really important, because especially if you're like semi-successful, people are going to throw so much work at you and ask you to be part of every project, because everybody needs a designer or an illustrator. So it's really make sure that you also see your personal time as a project, and you like book it in your, I don't work Saturdays, I don't work Sundays, because I'm exactly working on me.
Yeah.
I've always been very firm on this, and I think this has done me very well. There's this thing I sometimes say is that like my ultimate goal is to be able to be lazy. And what I mean, yeah, by that is that everything is working and I have enough work and everything is planned well and done well and there's coming enough money in so I can actually feel like I can relax.
Yeah, I think that's a really good advice. If you can be lazy, it sounds wrong, but it isn't, because I think that's ultimately what you're saying is you have the freedom to wake up and say, hey, I'm going to do this work today, or I'm not going to because I don't have to, right?
Exactly. It means, to me, it means you have ultimately everything in check.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, if anyone wants to reach out, like I'd be more than happy to give conversational advice on anything. My
website
is just my name. It's stev.ie.
Yeah.
And my email is there. So hit me up if you need to know anything or just want to chat about process.
I'll share both of your websites and social media in the show notes, if you don't mind, so people can reach out to you, cool, if they have any questions about how to deal with this,
absolutely,
stuff.
Yep. I wish I had that, like someone as a guiding light, not that I'm a guiding light, but I wish I had someone as a guiding light when I was starting out.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to have someone like that. So I know how valuable that is. So I will definitely help out where I can. At least.
Yes. Thank you both. And listeners, yeah, do reach out to both of them, because they're doing awesome work. And also Frederike, if they want to check out your work, I think it's frederikematti.com. Also,
yep,
leave the link in the show notes so you can check that out. Thank you for being on the show. Frederik, good luck on recording the second podcast after this.
I will.
Awesome. And Stevie,
thank you.
You're gonna travel again soon, or because of COVID you're staying in Amsterdam now?
Yeah, I think I'm kind of homebound for a little while until things figure themselves out. And then my main thing is getting back to Ireland sometime soon, because I haven't been home since last Christmas. It's been a crazy year.
Yeah. Hopefully we can have a Christmas and Sinterklaas with family and friends this year, but not looking like it, right?
Here's hoping, man.
Yes.
No, unfortunately not. Sinterklaas maybe not already, but Christmas maybe.
Cool. Thank you both for...
Thanks for having us. Thanks for having me.
No worries.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to this week's show. I'd love to hear what you thought about the episode. Also, do you have any follow-up questions for Frederik or Stevie? Let me know. Send a message to david@designers.fm or find me on Twitter @designers_fm. So that's david@designers.fm or Twitter @designers_fm. I'm your host, David, and this class is dismissed.